The LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour.
Hello and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Eric Newman, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Kate Wolf. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Eric.
On this week's show, Kate and I speak with Brad Gooch about his new book, Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. So, Kate, you know, obviously I'm a huge Keith Haring fan, which is certainly not a controversial opinion in an era when his work seemingly is everywhere and on everything imaginable. But I really like this as kind of as a biography that I knew a lot about Keith Haring's life, but there were still lots of personal details and kind of ins and outs of the development of his career that this book, I think, really brought into focus in a way that gave me a fuller picture, let's say, of Keith Haring's life and work.
Yeah, and I have to say I went into this more skeptical, maybe not as much of a Haring fan as others. but I thought the book did a great job of breaking down all these different currents that occurred in his life and the kind of making me see his career and its propulsion in some ways as separate from his art. And I think that gave me an idea of him as a more dynamic artist than maybe I imagined. I think I, you know, buckled a little at the commercialism that has, you know, taken up his work before he died, but much more rampantly, you know, since his death. And yeah. I really enjoyed learning about his life pre-meteoric takeoff. And I really liked this book. I thought it was beautifully done.
That's the other thing, is that I don't think it had quite, in some ways, I knew this, right? I know the dates of Keith Haring's life and work. But I think that what really was driven home for me in this interview, and certainly by the book, is just how compressed an amount of time it all happened in. Like, it was such a, as you said, like, that is the word. It was a meteoric rise of somebody that was very young. And I think sometimes the kind of criticisms, and we talk about this a little bit in the interview, the criticisms that I have are the kind of things that maybe I feel a little bit squidgy about some of Keith Haring's work. Brad Gooch really does a great job of breaking down, reminding us that this was a guy in his 20s. You know, he was an artist, in other words, that didn't really have time to mature because he was still so young and it was all happening so big and so fast.
Completely. Yeah, it's nuts to imagine how anyone would handle the kind of attention and fame he received at
exactly.
that young age. It's funny, actually. So the book has also a great kind of atmospheric New York in the 80s background, and it talks a lot about Keith going to the Paradise Garage and hanging with Madonna there. And then my friend went to the Madonna concert that was in LA recently, and she did whole skit about not being able to get into the Paradise Garage.
Oh, really?
They have
a
bouncer
amazing.
And they won't let Madge in. And she has to say, like, my name is Madonna, let me in. but I thought that was so funny. And there were lots of pictures of Keith Haring on the wall in the back, her and Keith. So.
Oh, that is so cool.
It was quite a time.
All right. Well, without further ado, let's get to that interview.
Great.
We're excited to have Brad Gooch with us on the line today. Brad is an award-winning writer whose work moves across genres including poetry, memoir, fiction, and biography. He's the author of numerous books exploring art, artists, sexuality, and cultural history, including City Poet, The Life and Times of Frank O'Hara, Smash Cut, A Memoir of Howard and Art and the 70s and 80s, The Golden Age of Promiscuity, and Rumi's Secret, The Life of the Sufi Poet of Love, just to name a few of my favorite titles, not necessarily in publication order. Brad joins us today from his home in New York City to discuss his latest book, Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. This richly detailed biography follows the iconic artist from his teenage experiments with drugs, art, and religion in the Kunsttown neighborhood of Pennsylvania during the 1970s through his meteoric rise in the New York art world in the early 1980s, his explosion into worldwide fame alongside Warhol, Madonna, and Jean-Michel Basquiat, and finally ending with Haring's untimely death in 1990. Filling in the gaps of Haring's storied career and work, Radiant plumbs the often colliding worlds of galleries, street art, gay sex, and political activism to bring to life an artist whose highly recognizable works dwarf and sometimes obscure their creator. What emerges from Gooch's account is a portrait of Haring as a man driven to make a mark on the world, as an artist who deliberately crossed the line between art and commerce, as an activist committed to combating the interlocking prejudices of racism and homophobia, and as a man always desperately seeking love, even as he struggled to sustain it in his most intimate relationships. Thanks so much for joining us today, Brad. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So, Brad, I was hoping that we could start by you just telling us how you came to Keith Haring's story. And as someone who's written so many biographies, I'm curious what it was like to work on this one, someone who was much more of a contemporary of yours and who you were aware of at the time of his life.
It is a long, winding road to that got me to writing a biography of Keith Haring. Beginning, as you said, I was in downtown Manhattan, in the East Village, at the same time that he was. He was living in 1978, 80 on First Avenue and First Street, and I was on Bleecker and Bowery. And so I would cross paths with his work every so often. Remember, my boyfriend and I were walking from the West Village to the East Village and saw these clones go home, stamped on sidewalks, started by this fake organization Keith had called Fags Against Facial Hair. So that was a very inside gay joke, you know, at the time. And then starting to see these crawling babies on a newsstand, I think in Soho, and then the subway drawings. And then I also crossed paths with him. He supposedly came to a book party Dennis Cooper and I gave ourselves for our new books of stories at the Limelight. I remember seeing him and his posse of sort of fabulous men and women taking up a whole row of the Apollo when it reopened. And then when my lover Howard Bruckner, who I wrote Smash Cut about that you were talking about, was sick with AIDS, Keith gave money for his care, which was characteristic of his generosity. And also I remember him at the funeral of Howard standing in the back looking sort of spooked because he was within a year of his own death from AIDS. So I had the, you know, this personal response, and from it always felt, at least through the 90s, that I wanted to write a novel about Keith Haring. And also at that time, they'd sort of faded. I mean, hard to believe now, but Basquiat, Haring had faded. There was some idea that the party was over. People were maybe in denial, and they are, you know, definitely returned. But especially at that moment, novel seemed the way to go and to bring this terrific force field of energy who I remembered to life. When it came time that I could actually had time to write a book and wanted to deal with Keith, then I realized first that I don't really like art novels about artists. I mean, you know, big famous artists, which he had become. And also the facts of his, you were saying, like kind of comet. I mean, this, what happened to him within 10 years and ended, I mean, almost exactly at 1990, begins almost exactly at 1980. The sort of Ripley, believe it or not, facts of his life and his art were so amazing that I really thought he needed biography in that way. As you said, it was certainly different for me to write about him than Rumi, who was a 13th century Muslim, and even than Frank O'Hara, who I was one or two degrees of separation away from. But doing the Haring book, I really, it was easier, I think is the way to put it, because I could kind of, I'd been in these places, so I could kind of fact check myself naturally. I knew what they looked like. I knew what they felt like. So I didn't, I wasn't feeling edgy about making certain kinds of mistakes that that you can fear if you're slightly making it up. I was never in the Cedar Bar, for instance, with Frank O'Hara, although I heard lots of tales and you can recreate it. But it did mean something to know who these people were, who I was writing about, and to understand that moment. Very important for someone like Keith Haring, who was emblematic of that moment.
In your acknowledgments, you kind of mentioned that you'd first approached the Haring Foundation with the idea of effectively writing in the wake of, but also an update of, John Gruen's authorized biography of Keith Haring. And I like the way that you put it as like a new full-scale biography of the artist for a new generation. Can you explain both a little bit what you meant by that, kind of what you felt, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but like what part of this story was missing, but also kind of how I imagine navigating that archive, which is so rich and detailed, must have felt incredibly overwhelming. But that's the raw material from which you can pull out these parts of a very, at this point, very well-known artist, the kind of unknown terrain. So can you just talk a little bit about that process?
I mean, the John Gruen book is a fantastic resource. I mean, it was being done. Keith wanted a biography of himself. I mean, he said at a certain point that everything that he learned from reading biographies of artists. So he believed in them and in the connection of life and work. And so Gruen was commissioned basically by Keith and therefore hooked up with all of Keith's friends alive at that time. So you have these interviews with William Burroughs and Madonna and John Giorno and Keith himself. There was 20 hours of tape of Keith telling his life story. Few tell it better than he could tell it. So that was all, really fantastic. I thought though what had happened within a few decades was that you'd sort of lost, at that time, we could all sort of take for granted that the readers of, say, that book would know what Club 57 was, what the Mud Club was, would really even understand what AIDS was like in downtown Manhattan. And for queer young people now, it's not so apparent, and it's not, you can't take all that for granted. So one thing I felt was helpful and was filling in the surround and the history of the period to sort of bring it to life. And the more you bring it to life, the more realistic yet astounding Keith's mission can seem. I mean, he was really an activist as well as an artist, and he was, working in this situation in which he landed. And his dealer, Tony Shafrazi, told me that Keith was a sponge, and he was in that sense. And so he was sort of working off his friends, the community, what he was seeing on the street. So all that needed some lively footnotes, at least, and hopefully this story. And also, left over from my earliest conception was that there was something novelistic still about this, and there was a kind of narrative story that propels you forward, because Keith propelled himself fast forward through so much.
I think that reading the book, I get a sense in so many ways of his story as tragic, and not, only because he contracted AIDS and died so young, but almost because of the machine of commerce and the art market and everything that he got caught up in, and the way that he rose to fame so quickly, even though that's what he wanted. But without being too critical, I do think you uncover this uncomfortable, possibly, that in a sense that things may have come too fast for him, that his career, if it hadn't entered into this particular kind of art market that was really ramping up. And especially as someone who's written about Frank O'Hara and the way things used to be, and then looking at this explosion in the 80s, that some of his life as an artist perhaps was a little undercut by the fact that he started to get into this thing of, one thing after another, after another, after another, and selling at this rate. And I wondered if that's something also that maybe took a long view to see.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the long view is also the view that works best with him, or that also makes this biography more necessary, I think. At the end of the book, I was talking to Ann Temkin, the curator of painting and sculpture at MoMA, and she was saying that for certain radical works of art, it takes 30 years for people to see them as they are. That happened with the lilies, it happened with the Abex painters, and it's happened with Keith. I mean, his work now, you see it in museums, all of a sudden you're struck by its enduring kind of quality, I think. But yeah, definitely looking back, then you see Keith caught in something, and it's a challenge and it's interesting. I thought the most helpful comment on that was his friend Kermit Oswald, who had been his art buddy in high school. And, you know, he just said that, and he was commenting about when Keith was the roommate of Kenny Scharf, his SVA art buddy, and dealers like the Rubels started to come in and buy up Keith's work, and they would walk by Kenny Scharf's work and not even look at it. And Kermit said, you know, as bright as the flame that was the life of Keith Haring was the shadow that it cast with people around him. And I think that, and Madonna talks about that coming up. I mean, she saw them as sort of separated at birth in a way, and coming up in this East Village scene, that when the two of them suddenly were art stars, music stars, going global, there was a lot of pushback from their original friends and from the East Village community. You know, and a lot of this is envy. So that was one situation Keith was dealing with. And then he also had these boyfriends who were different background class, one black, one Puerto Rican, and they kind of burn out around him. So suddenly you get very fast into this world with available drugs, all this money, moving very fast. And the only person who can deal with it, it's a little like Andy Warhol, is Keith, because he has this incredible work ethic and he's tunneling his way through. You know, and he's using everything for his work, but he's kind of working 24/7. And, you know, that's a great survival. I don't know if it was a technique, but, you know, I think helped him to survive. So it was indeed that he was in a world that had a lot of centripetal force going on, and he did sustain himself in certain ways through it. But you can watch the people around him to see just how challenging it could be, you know, and indeed, even for himself, he became such a kind of celebrity hound in a certain way. And some people see his work as thinning out for a while in the middle. I mean, he was just doing so much everywhere and then kind of rising at the end to some pretty great occasions. But the, you know, it was definitely a problem. And Keith was such a, in a way, innocent, naive through all this also that it helps him, and it also hinders him, I think, that kind of innocent, ambitious voice. I noticed I was surprised, I mean, in the earliest notebooks that Keith was keeping in journals when he was in Pittsburgh and 18 years old, there was this voice that was so innocent, naive, ambitious, and confident of himself in ways that seemed to everyone around him not to make sense. And did wind up making sense. But when I got to the end of the book, and then I'm listening to these last interviews with Keith, it's the same voice. I mean, you know, and the same view of himself and the same belief that art could change the world. So, he had, you know, it was a kind of utopian romanticism, living in a period that was growing increasingly cynical and bitter and devastating when you get to AIDS. I mean, I certainly think in terms of AIDS, that the final test here, you know, Keith definitely showed kind of great understanding of what was going on and was very realistic, and yet, you know, used it as an occasion to create more work, to go more places, and to still live more fully. I mean, he was very impressive to me, I think, at the end.
Yeah, I want to touch on, there's so many things that you have mentioned within just that response that I think are rich.
See the
threads.
Problem you
exactly,
have?
Exactly. I can only imagine what the outlining for this book must have felt like. But I want to actually talk just for a minute about the singularity of Haring's kind of vision and output. So kind of developing off of what Kate was talking about, he has this like seemingly almost like preternaturally keen sense for a visual language that directly and forcefully connects with his audience. So what I do love about the book is that, you know, the line doesn't just come to him sui generis, right? There is like a tradition that he's working in. But there's also a moment that you kind of, it's just like, it's so immediately gripping, the visuals that he produces, right? And there's a line in the book you have that describes this a little bit somewhat where you say, quote, Herring had a knack in his art for making the overlooked visible. So on the one hand, for me, this is all about that line, right? So the line he works with is very simple. You could say anybody could do that, right? They're not, you know, like super realistic or anything like that. And yet there is something about that line and the figures that he created on canvases and on many other materials that was so only his, right? And seemed like it had, everybody gets it. Can you just talk a little bit about what makes him unique and impactful as an artist, and also about artists like this who just have this, like I said, preternatural ability to just see and realize the thing that everyone else, trained and untrained, sees and recognizes?
You know, the line, I mean, it sort of begins with his father. So, you know, biographers, I think, always ascribe to the child his father to the man, that Wordsworth line. So you see him with his dad at age four. His dad is an amateur cartoonist, and he's encouraging, showing Keith Walt Disney and Dr. Seuss, but he's also encouraging him to do original cartoons. And, you know, that whole original cartoons is part of what is with Herring through his whole life. It's also fascinating, though, how to kind of watch him put together conceptually what he wants to do, and then to take the time to figure out how to do it, and, you know, and then to succeed. So you can see this happening at School of Visual Arts. The most important class to him there was semiotics. And it was the late 70s, so all the classes were performance art, conceptual art. And from semiotics, he really got this sense of developing a language. The idea of visual language had then become part of semiotics by the late 70s. And so he's very conscious of trying to find his language. And he's on the streets. He's seeing, you know, all the street art going on. He's on the subways. He's seeing the great moment of wild style with these big bubble letterings and this kind of acid color, TV colors. And he wants to be part of that. He wants to be part of that conversation, but he's not there yet. So you watch him thinking about that and making steps in that way. And the other concept is art for everybody. And he also gets this from semiotics class, that for art to be valuable in the sense of the marketplace, then it needs to be rare and there needs to be less of them, and then the value goes higher. And Keith always, I mean, progressive activist from childhood on also, is very into the idea of art for everyone and how you make art available for everybody and how you democratize it. And then there's one year, 1982, where these things come together. I mean, he, you know, in a couple of days does these first drawings of these images for a first show of paintings. And that's where you get all at once, the barking dog, the crawling human, the flying saucer, the exploding bomb. And that becomes his language. And it's not appropriated. You know, it's not expropriated. These are original cartoons that he's created. And I think that's one of the reasons they still communicate, in a sense. And I mean, there's something very hand-drawn about them. And then he starts doing them on the street. Then he sees these black matte spaces on the subways where ads go. And when there isn't an ad up, there's just this black square. And he starts chalk drawing those images on the subway, commentary in a way on the subway art that's going by on the subways, and yet different, right? And again, finding a space that no one has really noticed, including the graffiti artist. So he's speaking a language that people understand, and he's doing art in this vast underground gallery that belongs to him, you know, that millions of people could see every day. Not all do, but many do. It becomes a kind of question, since they're not signed, around town. Who's doing those drawings on the subway? And then it allows him to just make an end run around the art world at the time and have an audience of his own that he's created. So, you know, I think that preternatural is a good word for his drawing. I mean, when you, it's sort of always, you can get involved in these different discussions I certainly have of like, is Keith Haring a great artist? And is he greater than this artist or not as great as that artist? And, but you always, the thing where you just suddenly see there's something extra going on there is if you watch Keith Haring drawing and that he has these drawings in his head and he does them in, you know, at one sitting or one standing, and somehow he knows where everything is going to go because it wouldn't work otherwise. I mean, when you really look at those drawings, there are these kind of, you know, rebus cube kinds of puzzles too that he's doing. So, and that he wanted to communicate. I think that's part of the power that you were talking about in the imagery. He also said in an early SVA notebook, the message is the message, right? Countering the McLuhan, the medium is the message. So he wasn't an artist of surface and he wasn't ironic. And he was really interested in communicating activist messages, art messages, pleasure, music, dance, fun. I mean, all of this, but it wasn't an inside game in that way, purposefully.
I almost wasn't surprised to read that he was briefly a teenage Jesus freak growing up in Pennsylvania, because I think there is something evangelizing that continues in his work. And again, one of these kind of contradictions is that drawing is the most kind of pure form of art. It's in some ways a less commercial form. It's, you know, how many artists start a work as opposed to the end result. It does have the most kind of plain language element. It is the most kind of folk element of fine art. And he excels at that. And I love these images of him, like as a teenager, after he's done with Jesus, tripping on acid, just like sitting and drawing for hours. And suddenly everything is like starting to fit and geometrically, and he's just really going at it. But then again, it does seem like this contradiction of this form that is so pure, because he crafts this image and these icons that are so recognizable, it also in some sense leads to his commercialization.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it's interesting. I mean, he obviously, yeah, I love the Jesus freak stuff. And also you see the public artist. I mean, at very early, he's doing these Jesus Saves One Way kind of signs all over Kutztown to his parents' horror. I mean, his parents get characterized often as like they're sort of Marines and evangelical Christians, but that is not really the feeling of them at all. I mean, his father was an amateur cartoonist, and they went to Chocolate and Vanilla Methodist Church. They're a Christian because everybody went to church on Sunday. Having their son, you know, right, you know, putting up all this Jesus Saves material all over town was more radical and extreme than they really were looking for. But it's the beginning of that he wants to communicate, that he wants to communicate on a large scale, and that there's something that he's on a mission. He doesn't know what the mission is yet, but you see him as an artist on a mission from the beginning. I mean, Leo Castelli was later talking about how he was a better preacher than Jerry Falwell. I mean, that he just, there was something, you know, Keith's work was always communicating vehemently. In a way, I mean, he wanted people to agree with him. And the causes can morph, thinking, especially in this period that we are in, that Keith during the first Reagan election and Keith in the second Reagan election of 1984, where things were seeming more serious, and his sort of giving over his subway art to drawings about their anti-Reagan drawings or get out the vote kinds of drawings. So that kind of secular pulpit was something that mattered to him. And so he obviously had a religious, what we think of as feeling. I mean, he was anti-establishment church. He was, the Pope was another of his figures of evil in some of these drawings. And yet he winds up, I mean, the last major piece that he does at Yoko Ono's apartment within a month before he dies is this big Last Judgment altarpiece triptych that you can see at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York. It's in one in San Francisco, one in Paris. So you can take the boy out of Kutztown, you know, the Jesus freak out of Kutztown, but not the Jesus freak out of the boy.
You're listening to the LARP Radio Hour. We've been speaking with Brad Gooch, author of Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. We'll return to that conversation in just a moment, but first, we have this week's book recommendation.
We have Tana Friend on the line with us today. I'm giddy, but she is giving us a call to give us a book recommendation. Tana, what book are you going to recommend?
Hey, hi. Thank you for having me on for this. Okay, when I'm asked to recommend a book, I'm always going to go for probably the one that I have reread more times than any other, which is Watership Down. Well, a lot of people miss it because they think it's a kid's book because it's about rabbits. They sort of figure, yeah, this is probably, you know, somewhere along the lines of Peter Rabbit. It's really, really not. This is one of my favorite books because I read it the first time, I think I was either 6 or 7, right? And I probably missed about 2/3 of it. I just got the general gist. This one young rabbit has a premonition that something terrible is going to happen in the warren. And he convinces his brother and a bunch of other young ones to flee in search of somewhere else that's safe where they can build a home of their own. And along the way, they run into all kinds of interesting things. But when I first read it, I think that's all I got out of it. But every time I've reread it over the course of 40 years now, I found something new. It's got political levels. It's got levels about love and bonds and affection. It's got a coming of age element. And the writing is absolutely stunning. It has one scene in it that still makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up every single time I read it. It's got lines that make me cry every single time. It's practically every sentence in it is perfection. So I think this is one that's got something for everybody. It's hard to go wrong with this. This is my go-to recommendation.
What an incredible recommendation. I've not read Watership Down, I think, similarly, since I was maybe about 7 or 8, maybe a little bit older. And I remember being, in some way, I remember being devastated by it in a way where I was like,
oh, yeah,
I don't know if I can return to this. Like, I think this is too much for me as a child. But that's so interesting that you return to it. So how many times do you think you've read it?
It's got to be at least a dozen. And I swear I've found something new in there every time. And it does have scenes where you just hold your breath for 10 pages waiting to see what happens. But it's definitely worth a reread. It might not be quite as devastating as you remember, because everybody important does make it through okay. It's not carnage like apparently the movie. Apparently the movie's just carnage. At least, oh God. I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Okay, so if you want bunny carnage, you watch the movie. if you want a complex, interesting story that happens to feature rabbits, you read Watership Down. Can you tell us the title of the book again and the author?
It's Watership Down by Richard Adams.
Thank you, Tana, for that wonderful recommendation. Tana French's new book is called The Hunter. It's a novel.
You're listening to the LARP Radio Hour. We now return to our conversation with Brad Gooch, author of Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. You know, throughout the biography, you kind of witness Haring's grappling with the boundaries between, let's say, like high art and commerce, right? Which is not the same exactly as like commercial art, but the kind of selling of art. And those tensions kind of, at least in this part of the narrative, like come to a head when he opens the pop shop in New York in 1986. And there's a lot of different ways in which that pop shop can be read. And you do a great job, I think, of staging all the different ways that people understood it. But, you know, at least one way is that this is, you know, because it was not in a place that was seen as commercially viable, but it also seems like its own story of gentrification, kind of as it hangs on in that area. But it's also something that the kind of high art critics that you point to, they kind of rake him over the coals for it. And I think that this is one of the tensions in Haring's pieces that may also, to what you were saying before about maybe after 30 years have passed, he's seen differently. Because I think today, when we see, you know, and I own such pieces, you know, Herring's work is all over t-shirts, apparel, you know, toothbrush cases, almost anything, right? And I'm wondering if both why you think Herring was such a lightning rod for that kind of criticism, and whether or not the kind of commercial ubiquity of his designs has impacted his reputation as an artist today, or do we not see the same necessary or almost religious divide between high art and its kind of commercial viability or saleability?
Yeah, I think one of the aspects that has taken 30 years to make sense to us is that how you reach everybody, how you make art for everybody. And part of Keith's solution is the pop shop, where he's selling t-shirts and buttons, you know, in his own time. It wasn't licensing as now. But it is interesting the pushback that he got for that. He was getting pushback a lot at the time. I mean, Robert Hughes, who was a big critic of his at Time magazine, you know, liked to write about Keith Boring and John Michel Basquiat. He also called Basquiat the Eddie Murphy of art, which Keith was quick to point out was racist. Keith had a pretty high consciousness about racism in American life. Also, he called Keith a disco decorator. And, you know, again, it's not just, it's also there's homophobia in these. When you read these old reviews, it's, you know, there's that shadow going through it. And I think that was part of it with Keith. So all of this, like, that art's supposed to be, I remember Diego Cortez, who was curator of the New York New Wave show, kind of important guy at the time, and who died of COVID, like, in the middle of my book. I talked to him a lot before, but I think it was him, told me that, oh, art in the 70s was white rooms with white people drinking white wine. And so there is that sense to it. And the more they started to mess with this, the harder it became. So that, you know, that art was more cerebral, and it was, you had to have a lot of references to get it, I think. I mean, you had to learn. You couldn't just walk into a gallery necessarily and understand a Carl Andre piece. And Herring's art was, you know, which is fine, but, you know, and Herring was doing something accessible and seductive at the same time, many things like that. So I think people just didn't necessarily get the joke sometimes. And also Keith was making art about some pretty serious subjects and about gay liberation and apartheid and nuclear proliferation. But he did it in these bright, kind of cartoony colors, so that people didn't quite sometimes see how dark the content could actually be, or how serious the content could actually be. I think Warhol kind of did the opposite, which is he took these kind of silly subjects and treated them seriously. Keith took very seriously things and gave them a silly kind of brush.
Good that you mentioned Warhol, because I wanted to ask about their very close relationship. And, you know, I was in the book, you write about when Warhol died, Robert Hughes wrote this very, you know, stinking eulogy for him in Time, and that Keith responded, you know, very upset by that. Keith felt very close to Warhol. I'm sure that Warhol kind of helped ushered him into this, you know, celebrity art world. But they also have, I think, other things in common in terms of a certain, you know, naivete, maybe more feigned on Warhol's part, an innocence, Pennsylvania boys, an interest in business art, which I'd love for you to explain what that is.
Sure. I mean, I thought, one of the people asked me, what did you find out that you didn't know writing this biography? And there are a few things, but I never quite understood the closeness of the relationship between Warhol and Herring. I mean, you see them all bunched together in all these different photographs. But they really, I mean, first just had daily morning phone calls, you know, kind of processing the information of what happened the night before. But also as a conceptual kind of influence, Herring was the it wasn't anxiety of influence, it was pleasure of influence. But Warhol was the main figure for Keith. And even though he saw their work as being different, he also saw himself. He said at one point, I mean, there might be other people coming along, but at the moment, I'm the best person to carry on what Warhol was trying to do. So that taste of the popular, I think, in a way, and working with the material of popular culture and opening up art to be in a club setting. I mean, Warhol had done that, for instance, working in these different mediums. All that came from Warhol. There was a practical aspect that came from Warhol, which is he hooked him up with a lot of important galleries in Europe and sort of helped him that way. And the reverse. I mean, the Warhol's relationship with Haring and Basquiat kind of made him relevant at that moment in a way he might not have been. So he was part of that energy. Basquiat got Warhol to start painting again. And so there was a kind of back and forth to it all. In the Pop Shop, I mean, Keith took Warhol kind of one step further. So you really, Warhol loved using pop culture and the images of television as material. And it's sort of material on which he was commenting or being Sphinx-like in a certain way and was of a certain generation. You know, Keith was of this next generation where he was gaga about this stuff. I mean, he loved the Monkees. He loved television. He had just a different attitude towards that kind of material. And then he also then in the Pop Shop opens a store. No other art star of the 80s opened a store. And even Warhol in his diaries kind of questions it at certain points. Like, oh, maybe he really is Peter Max, or, well, he's not, you know, but it's just his store and he's not selling it. He's trying to work his way through this concept. And then arguing, I mean, Warhol would, like with Paige Powell, who's at the factory, you know, have to sort of argue that Keith is a fine artist. And Castelli said that the Pop Shop is a work of art, but not everyone saw that. And that was a worry for Keith in a way that he was going to be erased by these, you know, the big eraser from history. Turns out those people didn't have as much power as they thought they had, and the world changed a lot. But that, it's a hard line that he was trying to walk, Keith, in extending this, what you said, business art. So he wanted, you know, he was finding ways that people could buy art and know for a couple dollars, right? At the same time, you have like people writing in the New York Times and those opening stories about the Pop Shop, like this is some big money grab that, you know, that he's making, like he's going to pocket $2 for these things. He actually lost money on the Pop Shop. I don't know if it was ever intended to really make money. But, you know, it takes a Keith Haring to have the taste factor and sense of his own work about how far to go. So when he then opens the Pop Shop in Tokyo, you know, he's having all these rules, like it can't be part of a department store, can't be taken over by corporations. And, you know, now we're in a world where licensing is king, you know, and then now the debate is, has it gone too far? You know, are there too many Keith Haring toothbrushes? But part of the reason we're talking about Keith Haring now is there was then a second generation of artists who took him up, I think, and that can't be forced. So you get artists like Kaas and Banksy and Shepard Fairey, and all these sort of Keithian tendencies become very common. I mean, public art, licensing, building of community, developing, you know, personal languages, all of this, and certainly crossing lines of popular culture into music and fashion, all this has been in part moved. So Keith and Kenny Scharf and that generation came to New York in part to be Andy Warhol, the kind of Andy Warhol of the factory of the 60s. That was part of their fantasy. And there are definitely younger artists around who own their appreciation of and debt to Keith Haring. in what they've been inspired to do, and the feeling that they can make t-shirts and show in museums, and this is no longer an aesthetic Berlin Wall.
It seems in some ways like it has almost more to do with music, with the way music works. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to completely pass over the fact that something that was so inspiring to Keith Haring seems like getting to New York, going to the Paradise Garage, being immersed in music, and in particular Black music, and that has to be as much a part of his work as Warhol.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the music, when Keith came to the East Village in 1978, rock music was the dominant art form. And there would be plastered on walls, doors, construction sites, these signs for rock concerts, for television at CBGBs. So the band form, I remember, well, writing City Poet, the poet James Schuyler said in the 50s, I think he said poets and painters were in the same boat, but painters were steering. And it was sort of in that time, artists and rock bands were in the same boat, but the rock bands were were kind of determining the mood. And I remember the thing when I was talking about my conversations with Diego Cortez, and when he put together the New York New Wave show, which was also kind of criticized at the time, seen as seminal now, his concept was music and artists that were coming out of music and the crossover. There was a room, there was a shrine to John Lennon who had been shot. And there was a kind of Rolling Stone aesthetic to it. And it was very different, even from what was going on with the other young 80s artists like David Sally or Ross Bleckner or Robert Longo and the Mary Boone artists who were bringing expressionism back into painting and color and paint and all those things. But this was then a different thing where it was coming out of Warhol and rock music and these connections. So, and also Keith painted to music, and his first lover, Juan DuBose, who was a DJ, made him these tapes, and Keith painted to the tapes. Mm. So there was always a collaborative element with music.
This also reminds me of another thing that I kept thinking about throughout the biography, and that is kind of Keith's relationship to Black and Latino culture and also to the Black and Latino community. So obviously he draws heavily from the worlds of street art and hip hop as it was kind of emerging in the 80s, frequently collaborated with, and as you've mentioned, also kind of dated both Black and Latino men, including Juan DuBose and longer term Juan Rivera. But there are moments throughout the biography where those relationships can feel, I'm not sure if this is exactly the right word, but like a little fetishizing, particularly in some of the notes from his journal, where he describes loving Rivera almost specifically because Rivera is a sex object. And he kind of lionizes their butch qualities in ways that feel very reductionist. And I love the moment where you describe Bill T. Jones kind of observing that Haring is almost, I think sometimes maybe willfully ignorant of the power imbalance in his relationships with, certainly with both Juans, definitely DuBose, but Rivera, it seems like, had a little bit more of a sense of independence. But, you know, and there's also been complaints by LA2, the art name for Angel Ortiz, that complained he was not adequately compensated by the foundation or by Haring for the kind of works that they collaborated on together. And so this kind of all suggested to me perhaps maybe a more problematic relationship between the artist and his embrace of Black and Latino culture, as well as Black and Latino men, that I may not have necessarily thought about as deeply before. So I'm curious if you kind of, and this is always maybe dangerous or tendentious to do, but kind of seen from today's lights, how might we read this aspect of Haring's art and personal life? Is this kind of fetishization or appropriation, as, you know, critics like Ricardo Montes and Keith Haring's line, race and the performance of desire, has kind of worked through? Or is it something else? You know, kind of how do you square with those questions?
Yeah, these are very interesting questions. And part of the 30 years retrospect that's different. I mean, you also see other things that you hadn't seen, which maybe Keith didn't see. You know, Keith was, yes, he was definitely fetishizing Black and Latino men. I mean, no doubt about this. And he was kind of, and even, I remember Ingrid Cici said when Keith Haring came to Paradise Garage, it was like Gauguin coming to Tahiti. Yes, but Gauguin is also problematic in a certain way. I think, so part of the relationships with these guys, to start there, is immature, I think. I mean, you know, Keith was in his 20s, and I remember what that was like to be in your 20s and to be in your 20s in the 70s and the 80s. and in this situation where he's getting, where he's blowing up. So one wishes for him greater maturity, and it seems to come later. But there is a way in which early on, and there's also a way in which Keith is very visual. I wouldn't put naysays on the scale necessarily, but you know, he's going through life and he's seeing, I mean, even when he has his girlfriend for 2 years, Susie, in Pittsburgh, he describes her as, oh, she's perfect for me. She's like the same height and she has curly blonde hair and she's like a hippie, something like that. He meets Juan DuBose. He's always perfect for me. He's black. He has a big dick. We're the same age. I mean, like there's a way in which you're not getting a lot of depth here, Keith, but at the same time, and again, this is the personal part of it, I always think about Robert Mapplethorpe, who I also knew, and Robert Mapplethorpe also had relationships almost entirely with black men in his case. And whatever fetishization and objectification they did was very different. So Mapplethorpe was really playing with the stereotypes in a way that could be mean, really, and highly eroticized for him. Keith always wanted to be part of the community. You know, he loved having dinner with Angel Ortiz's mother. He loved going and having Thanksgiving with Juan DuBose's sister. He really wanted to be part of this culture, and that made a difference. I mean, there was a lot of fantasy going on, but there was a lot of humanity going on similarly, I think, in those kinds of relationships. And also the activism. I mean, Keith was writing as a senior in high school this essay about Geronimo, in which he has all this language about basically the white patriarchy of the president and what they had done to Native Americans. I mean, he was 12 years old. He went to the first Earth Day rally at Kutztown State Campus. So one of the issues that he took on from the very first drawings was black-white relations and later apartheid. So I think this is also different. I mean, there was a fuller dimension to his involvement with those communities and also his relationship to the art then, which I am asked about. You know, to what sense is he ripping off subway artists? And, I mean, even that would, first of all, subway artists were all types. I mean, there were black and Puerto Rican men, there were women, there were white kids, there, you know, so just that in itself, to me, see, has its own, isn't as deep as you might go. But I think, again, Keith was aware of these things, and so he was always respectful. So when he started doing street art, or you could call it savvy, but he would put his drawings on the bases of lampposts on the street. So people got used to, like, looking down for Keith Haring graffiti. He wasn't competing. And similarly with the subway, he wasn't like dressing up and trying to be a subway artist and riding the trains with spray paint. He never used spray paint. And he had found like art student-y. He found these black like blackboards and was doing chalk drawings on them across from the subways, and it was a kind of homage in a way, but also different. So I think those are the complicating elements of it. And so I think both are true, but you need to think of both sides at once. I mean, I haven't, you know, interestingly, also at the time, there was a kind of mutual respect going on. So he wasn't criticized by Fab Five Fred, you know, he was respected, and on the streets, his work was respected, and he was curating shows, you know, at the Mud Club, of these kind of graffiti artists who are now working on canvas and things. So he had, yeah, a kid-like erotic objectification and fascination and fanboy attitude, and, you know, was inspired by this art, and that was just the way it was. I mean, it was a slightly different time. All of the above is true. And I guess my bottom line to me is that it had to do as much with kind of immaturity as ill will or trying to rip anybody off.
Were you able to get a sense of how at the end of his life he was envisioning his impact or kind of dying with a sense of what he had done or what his work meant or having felt complete somehow by what he accomplished? Or was it that he felt, you know, passionately that he still wanted more life and more work?
He talks about this. I mean, when he's diagnosed as HIV positive, first of all, unlikely route at the time, he goes public as a person with AIDS in Rolling Stone magazine. This is the time when, you know, Rock Hudson is dying and claiming he doesn't have AIDS, and Roy Cohn is practically coming back from the grave to say that he has pneumonia or something. I don't know. You know, obituaries at the time, everyone was dying of pneumonia. No one was dying of AIDS. No one had long-term partners. That was the general take. So he comes out about this and talks very much about his mortality and, you know, embraces it. I mean, he even says it's kind of a plus in a way, because, you know, when you're telling a story, you have all these pieces in motion. And then as you get to the end of the story, you kind of have to get to what the story is really about, and things need to find some resolution. And he found that in his art, that he was trying to do that at that time. Rather than wasting away in that last year or so, he just revved everything up. I mean, he created more and more and more art, and he went to more and more and more places. He was working in the studio until 3 weeks before his death, and he was very conscious of creating work. I mean, that's, he always said working made him happiest. He had this incredible work ethic, workaholicism, whatever it was. But, you know, he was conscious of doing as much as he could. But, you know, and saying, everybody dies eventually. If I lived, which sounds very true, if I lived until I was 70, I would still have work that I wanted to create. You know, we're a chain. There are people who went before. There are going to be people who come after me. So by those days, he had this kind of wisdom, I think, about his life and work. So he didn't see it as you said tragic, but he worked against, you know, defining it as tragic or his output.
As we just kind of wrap up, I'm wondering if there's anything that you think you'd most want readers to take away from this book, or kind of how you think, you know, in 2024, kind of how does Keith Haring resonate with the kind of questions that animate the contemporary art world?
I think he's very inspiring in this sort of do-it-yourself aesthetic and career. He worked where he was, right? He worked with whatever materials he had. He wasn't really, I mean, he wanted to be a great artist, but he was finding his own way through it. And certainly in terms of activism, I think to do this subway project, which amounted at the end to 5,000 works of art over 5 years, one of the largest public art projects ever, and to have so much of it taking on the issues of the time and the headlines, I think that's very inspiring. This, because, you know, sometimes we can feel that it's all gotten to be too much. I mean, there's just no way that one person can make a difference. And so Keith's way of making a difference in this, you know, very kind of personal manner, both in art and in life and in thinking, you know, I would sort of take some of that away.
That sounds great.
These were tough times.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that. We've been speaking with Brad Gooch, author most recently of Radiant, The Life and Line of Keith Haring. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you.
The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolfe, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Bame. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vlotten.